Hold on a
No.
second. Hold on a second. I'm not going to let these guys sit here and let you say it like this.
Yeah, I was
about
going
to
correct
say
him in a
it's.
second.
Me
it's
too.
Jermaker.
Oh my
That's how you
God.
pronounce it. Because if you think about it has a reggae influence to it. That's the humor of it.
And it's from a joke.
Yes.
Nope.
What?
Okay.
I was helping you out.
Yeah, whatever.
I didn't want nobody saying nothing to you.
Let's see if I can get some emails. It's fine. Hello, I'm Jason Dantzis.
I'm the professor.
I'm Ian Rice.
I'm Lou Figaro.
And I'm David Hudson.
And welcome to Ridiculous Rock Record Reviews, a podcast where we discuss and review a rock record of our choice. Today, we will be discussing the 1973 album from English rock band Led Zeppelin, Houses of the Holy. We got a large crew to discuss this record, which is fitting for a record of this magnitude. You guys can decide how much of your background with this band and record you want to share, but let's start with Lou.
I've known Led Zeppelin since I'm like a toddler. It was really my first taste of something heavy, something with fuzz. I was immediately drawn to it. The fuzz, like the Beatles Revolution, only even heavier, screamier, if that's a word. I had the 45, Whole Lot of Love. And if you held your head just right and relaxed your eyes when you stared at the pinwheel on the Atlantic Records label, it was spinning the opposite way the record spun. I don't know why I remembered that, and I don't know why I shared it. I really got into them late middle school, really got into them all the way and then all the way through high school. I knew a lot of these songs from the Song Remains the Same soundtrack, which I listened to more. I had it on a TDK 90 that I had to cut sections of Dazed and Confused so I could fit it all on the one side of the tape. Then in the 90s, they released the two box sets. And I was hooked all over again. And Houses of the Holy was always in my collection, and it still is.
So Led Zeppelin was the first band that I really listened to. And Lou, I did the same thing with The Song Remains the Same. Mine was the end of A Whole Lot of Love. I had to cut back, and I still know where that cut is because that's what I still hear when I listen to that album.
Yeah, I do too, in Dazed and Confused.
That 90-minute Memorex.
And that damn skip on Whole Lot of Love.
Yeah, and I don't know why.
My record skips right there.
I don't know why I didn't cut out Moby Dick, but I left that all in there because I could have done without hearing that thing go for what, like 18 minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was the first band I listened to that I really listened to. And they're a band that even after 40 years of listening to them, I still marvel at. I know the order in which they were released, but that's not the order that I got them. I first heard and recorded The Song Remains the Same on that cassette tape. And call it musical imprinting or familiarity or whatever, I've always gravitated to those versions of the songs more than their studio cuts. Song Remains the Same, Rain Song, and especially No Quarter. Talking about the original 1976 version, not the 2007 remaster that cut parts of No Quarter out, which I still don't understand why they did that. Two and four, or Untitled, or Zoso, or whatever you want to call it, were the first two that I got. Not long after I got Physical Graffiti and In Through the Outdoors Christmas Gifts. I think it may have been over a year until I got this one. So this was like spring 81-ish. I do remember anticipating listening to the studio cut of No Quarter. By the time I got this album, I'm sure the only studio album that was missing from my collection was Presence, and Coda had yet to be released. So that's my history with this album and Zeppelin.
It's Lou brought up the box sets that came out, and my friend, who's sadly passed away now, my friend David, and I, we were too broke to afford the big box set. But a couple in like 92, they released remasters, like a truncated version of it. So we split that, and half of Houses of the Holy was on that collection. So I, it's kind of the stuff I gravitated to. It was the first full Zeppelin album I bought was Houses of the Holy. I, you know, it's very confusing that none of the records actually have a title until you get to Presence, I believe. And, but I've always been a big Zeppelin fan. And of course, you know, years later they would cross over into my other love, which is the Black Crowes. You know, they kind of teamed up with Jimmy Page and did Zeppelin tunes all over again. That kind of reawakened my interest in Led Zeppelin all over again. Because if you live in New York, and I'm sure the same is true for you, Lou, and anywhere in kind of the tri-state area, classic rock radio plays the hell out of Led Zeppelin. So, I mean, you don't even need to own. If we turn on FM radio, classic rock somewhere right now, a track from House of the Holy is probably playing right now. So you kind of get oversaturated with it. But if you step back for a while and then jump back into it, Led Zeppelin always delivers, and it's always gold. And they're just one of those bands that are timeless.
I grew up, my dad was big into the Stones, And I was probably in the eighth grade. No, I was probably younger in eighth grade. I remember we were going somewhere on Friday night, and my dad goes, "I got you something special." He handed me Led Zeppelin 4 on cassette. He goes, "Memorize it. It's a great album." And for the longest time, I thought the only music they put out was Led Zeppelin 4 and Whole Lot of Love. I'm sure this isn't unique to like Memphis or whatever. All the classic rock radio stations did it, but Get the Lead out on Friday night. And I heard that the first time. I was like, "Dad, how are they going to fill 90 minutes with Led Zeppelin?" He was just kind of like, "Well, you know, watch out." And those were kind of the songs that I knew. And then in college, there was the box set, and somebody had it. And none of us could really afford it completely. So we would just kind of like swap the CDs around. It was probably 97, 98 before I knew what songs were on what albums. Because of that, I gravitated to "Hey, Hey, What Can I Do?" and "Traveling Riverside Blues." I did not know that those were like unreleased tracks, and it was kind of like the holy grail to get those. Still to this day, a lot of my Zeppelin listening is just pulling up like the greatest hits. Now, Physical Graffiti is my favorite Zeppelin album. It's too big. There needs a few less songs. But Houses of the Holy, if you're talking about percentages of great songs, it 4 and 2 are the ones that have the highest hit right now. There's two songs on here I do not like, and that they're pretty cringeworthy for me. But this is a great album. I was kind of surprised to see it sold over 10 million copies in the United States. I wouldn't have thought it would be quite that much. But anyway, everybody goes through a Zeppelin phase, just like everybody goes through a Pink Floyd phase. And I listened to Led Zeppelin in spurts. I'll go a week or two. That's mainly what I listen to. Then a year later, I'm like, "I listened to Zeppelin lately."
Yeah, for me, in the early 90s, started getting into grunge and alternative rock and all of that 90s stuff. You know, it's kind of the core music love that I have, birthed in the 90s. And one of the things that came out in the 90s was the tribute record to Led Zeppelin that had several songs from this record on it. You know, Stone Temple Pilots doing Dancing Days and Sheryl Crow. And, you know, I loved that so much. There it is, Encomium.
Oh, one of the greatest tribute albums ever.
Yes.
Pick that Todd's Tangerine, man.
Yes.
And so, Blind Melon's on that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they do Out on the Tiles, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, that's why I bought it.
Yeah. So I just loved that. I listened to that so much front and back. And then somehow, I can't tell you how, but I did acquire that box set you guys are talking about, the one with the crop circles on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow I realized, I don't remember if it was a bunch of buddies or our, what, we started going through each record and going which tracks were on which, and we realized if we bought the second box set, then we'd have all of it. Because between the two box sets, you had every track, plus those unreleased ones that David talked about. So we bought that, and then we just made mixtapes. We just cranked out mixtapes that was basically, here's your Memorex of each record, and started distributing them in the dorm. Just got heavy into it. It was a ton of fun. So that's how I got into Led Zeppelin, was through Blind Melon, Stone Temple Pilots, Sheryl Crow, etc. It was great.
I bought that box set off of Dave Lewis, who writes the Tight But Loose fanzine for Led Zeppelin in Bedfordshire, England, from the HMV record store in 1990. And that thing cost like, it was close to $90 at the time. So, yeah. And then I had to buy it in English pound, so it was twice as much.
I have no idea how I got that thing, especially hearing you guys talk about how you couldn't afford it. I'm sure I couldn't. Probably stole it from somebody. Yeah, well.
Jason.
Well, I'm wondering why you guys all didn't go to the library and just lift their copies.
Oh, I used to do that all the time, too. Just upload them into the computer. Yeah.
I'm going to take this, and it's probably not going to come back.
Yeah. So. Quite grasp the concept of borrowing, right? That's
right. Well, it's more on a permanent basis. It's just a length of time.
All right. Let's dig into Houses of the Holy. Let's start with getting some basic facts about this record, which I consulted the Naked Baby out at my waterfall out back, and they gave me the whole scoop, starting with go to Wikipedia. So here we are. Houses of the Holy is the fifth studio record released by English band Led Zeppelin, released March 28th, 1973 in the U.S., and 2 days later, March 30th, 1973 in the UK. Unusual that an English band would release later in the UK, but that's what happened. Recorded December 1971 through August 1972. Recorded in the Rolling Stones mobile studio at Stargroves in Headley Grange. In case you don't know what Stargroves is, that's Mick Jagger's house. Also recorded at Island and Olympic Studios in London. It's produced by Jimmy Page. Released on Atlantic Records, it is certified diamond by the RIAA. Reached the top 10 in a multitude of countries, except for the Danish charts, where it only reached number 24. Let's talk about who is in the band. Led Zeppelin is Robert Plant on vocals, Jimmy Page on guitars, John Paul Jones on bass guitar, piano, mellotron, organ, synthesizer, backing vocals on The Ocean, John Bonham on drums, and also backing vocals on The Ocean. There aren't any other musicians to speak of. These four guys do it all.
I got context.
Do you want to insert some context here?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Prof.
So Led Zeppelin released their fourth album to massive success after the curveball that was Led Zeppelin III, which I'm not saying is bad at all. In fact, it's just the opposite. But at the time, everybody went, what? They wrangled with the record company about the album cover and about not having the band's name on the cover. All of the symbolism on the fourth album has meaning of self-belief and forging their own way, from the man with the sticks on the cover to the climbing of the mountain on the inner gatefold to the runes they chose to represent themselves individually. They wanted the music to speak for itself, and it did. So here they are now, with years of multiple tours under their belts, riding the crest of the wave of their successes, and they're fully established as a band. Now they have a follow-up. They've already proven to be interested in their own musical direction, regardless of expectations. Their motto was ever onward. January 1972, Page moved from his Pangbourne boathouse on the Thames to Plumpton Place in East Sussex, where he installed a home studio. The board he installed was the same board that was used to record The Who's Live at Leeds and them at Earl's Court, or not Earl's Court, at Royal Albert Hall. And I suspect the Rolling Stones' Get Your Leeds Lungs Out was also recorded there. It was a popular soundboard that was from their 70 tour and officially released on the Sticky Fingers Super Deluxe. John Paul Jones also installed a home recording studio. This is pertinent later. After a week's rehearsal at Islington Farmhouse in Dorset in February 72, they went on an Australian tour. Plant's voice cracks in concert. Often his ability to hit the high notes of a year before become a struggle. Of course, opening with the Immigrant Song, Heartbreaker, and Black Dog in a 1-2-3 punch doesn't help. Neither does smoking cigarettes, but hey. They were supposed to go to Singapore. Those dates were canceled because the visas for the band were not granted because they had long hair. Singapore is a trip. March 72, Page and Plant go on to Bombay on their way back from the Australian tour. It's their world music theme. They record with the Bombay musicians, Four Hands and Friends, which was heavily bootlegged and finally released on Coda in 2015. And they're exceedingly boring renditions of those songs. But hey, for completists, they have to have it. April 72, they start recording at Mick Jagger's country estate, Stargroves, in East Woodhay, Hampshire, because Headley Grange was unavailable. That's where they recorded four. They use the Rolling Stones mobile studio. Page comes in with the overture, with a working title of The Campaign, later renamed The Song Remains the Same, The Rain Song, with a working title called Slush, then Seasons, then ultimately the Rain Song. Many, many times, originally worked from the Led Zeppelin Brongeyer material for Led Zeppelin 3. And John Paul Jones comes in with no quarter. Incidentally, the weekly rent at Stargroves was £1,000. On April 22nd, Carrick Plant was born. He died in July 1977, which ended their last U.S. tour. In May 72, mixing and overdubs began at Olympic Studios London. So they recorded it really quick. This was not an album that they were like, we're going to spend a lot of time with. This was literally like 3 weeks that they actually laid the basic tracks down before his son was born. And then he booked. So that's my context so far.
And there you go. And obviously wedged between two of, one iconic record and another one that's probably universally dubbed as their masterpiece. It's an interesting spot for this record to fall, but it did reach number one U.S. Billboard charts, number one in the U.K. Billboard charts. So this album is no joke for being recorded in that context. So, all right, let's dig in. The record opens with, written by Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, "The Song Remains the Same."
Was intended to be an instrumental orchestral overture for the album. It's a pastiche incorporating blues, Indian raga, Japanese, rockabilly, jazz, and finger-picking licks, as well as an homage, or an homage, to Yes's Steve Howe. The song starts off as a dynamic tour de force. They're going to put you through the sonic paces. The three of them are all athletic, agile, and vicious on their instruments. Led Zeppelin has entered the building and no one has left it with a doubt about it. Jimmy used a Strat, Tele, and a Fender 12-string. And if you listen close, you can hear the distinctive sounds for the Strat and the Tele adding overdub licks, passages, and a solo here and there. Because of Plant's diminishing vocal range, someone came up with the brilliant idea to have the band recorded in D major and then slow the tape down to C for Robert to sing and then speed it back up to D for the album. The trick was somehow able to change the pitch without dramatically changing the tempo. It does, however, neuter the bottom end and thins out the song's soundscape or sonic landscape. You really notice this when listening with a good pair of headphones. You want them to be more. You can feel that there's space there. With the overdubs and the quest for no muddiness at the speeding up of the song and the final product lacks the punch of live versions, and Plant's voice sounds like he's auditioning for the Chipmunks. The quest for no muddiness was from a holdover from Led Zeppelin 4, which was originally mixed at Sunset Sound Studios. Played back there on the studio monitors, it sounded just like what Page was going after. Clear and defined. Separation. He had everything he wanted. But when he played it back for the band in England, the sound was muddy and nothing like what he had heard in L.A. And this caused an emergency remix, and Page was still not fully satisfied with the end result. So they wanted to avoid that completely. So the amount of work that they put into the song also has it sounding a little stiff. Like I said, I was used to the live versions before I ever heard this. That's Led Zeppelin to me, and this just sounds just so stilted. John Paul Jones and Bonham are holding it all down with the busy, sophisticated bass line and plenty of breathtaking fills, which he takes to a whole new level live because he got himself a timpani, which is that big Indian drum that he can play all those different things with, and he just beats the hell out of it on stage. Lyrically, again, this was originally intended to be an instrumental. Plant took it to be his message of rock and roll or music is universal, and it's not as flower power hippy-dippy as he could get, nor is it especially profound. It's kind of like, thanks, Captain, obvious statement. I like this song, but I really like it live much better than what I hear on this.
Okay, I cannot go after him anymore the rest of the thing. I can't.
It'll be fine.
We just got a TED Talk on that song. This is one, you know, obviously they really like because it was played a lot on different tours. But I got to think that galloping on there, I think the guys in Iron Maiden may have listened to that. Maybe a little precursor to what they did. I love Led Zeppelin when they change tempos, go from fast to this kind of almost like heady space with this. It's a great opening song. It's got the feel of an epic, even though it isn't like epically long. But you would see them use this kind of tempo again later on in other, I'm special on like Presence and things like that. But one of the faster songs in the catalog, my take on it, it's about life on the road. Pick up, go one place, have the time of your life, pick up and go to the other place. But I do love those breakdowns. Plant comes in there. And I love the register with which he's singing at. But after what Ray said, that's about all I can say and not look like an idiot.
Well, here's their ta-da. I mean, how do you follow up that last record when an album that happens to be Led Zeppelin 4? Well, here it is. This one starts out with the Jimmy the Magician weaving his spell as multi-track guitars ride over a skipping bass drum. Bonzo brings it to a halt as he slows the whole thing down, and a flurry of Roberts enter, sounding like the slightly singed leftover flower child past the apocalypse, introducing us and laying out the story. He had a crazy dream. He had an out-of-body experience. He could go anywhere where all the questions of the universe were answered. Rambling on through the flower patch, singing his little song in the California sun, or Indian rain, or even Hawaii. The song's the same. I don't know what flavor orange sunshine my man's on, but I want some. Sing out the hari hari. Dance the uchiku. I'll have what he's having. To make up for it, Jimmy weaves enough evil to cause Robert to sprout three heads, all speaking in tongues like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, backward and forward, babbling and cooing. Whining and pleading, screaming like he's got his dick caught in his zipper. And he's got people in the booth trying to help him out. And he sounded like some spoiled little girl whose mom didn't buy her a Barbie in the toy department at Target. Push, push, yeah. Shit, that's gonna hurt. Who's he pushing? What's he pushing? Where's the bridge?
Fuck me. I like Led Zeppelin.
That was cool. You know that part where he goes like that and he goes, that was cool.
This song, I will say, if I can add anything to this discussion at this point. I did always like the fact that the intro is like, you know, a year and a half long on this thing. That was so new to me at the time. It was the first time I ever heard a band kind of do something like that, where, you know, normally rock songs, you get right to the point, you know, you're in there in a couple of seconds. I mean, this is an epic. You start an album with an epic. I've honestly never, to my recollection, seen many live versions of this, but personally, but I can imagine that this is a good way to open a show. So I think this is a great tune. I always enjoyed it.
It's been brought up a couple times about the epicness of the track, and I made kind of the same notes. The track's only just over 5 minutes long, but it feels like it's a big opus. To what Ian just said, it's only a minute 28, the opening instrumental. It's not that long, but it feels like there's a lot of stuff that happens in a minute and a half. You know, a lot of time changes, a lot of different grooves, a little different melodies. They do a lot in there. Slows down for the vocal. I always thought the vocal was weird. Now I know why. Thank you, Prof. Wasn't my favorite part of the song. I always felt like it would have been better as an instrumental. Although I do like it about 3 minutes into the song when the vocals come in over the up-tempo part. And I also made the note, like, it feels like it's a this long epic song, but it's not really. But they get a lot done in 5 minutes. So good on them, especially as the first song you're going to hear coming off of Four. So great way to start this record. So we're going to change gears right out of the gate from the big epic opus to, an actual epic opus, The Rain Song.
This is odd placement in the flow of this album. To me, it kind of messes up the flow a little bit. I would have put The Ocean in right here, but anyway, I digress. Here's one of the things. This is one of the real near misses for them, in my opinion. This song has so much potential, but they drag that slow part out about a minute too long. But when it kicks in, talking about just audio ecstasy. Favorite moments in the Led Zeppelin catalog. They hadn't ever really written a true love song, and I believe it was George Harrison told them that, like, you guys don't write love songs. And so this was Plant's response to it. The lyrics are obviously very upbeat and positive. You know, in the springtime of my loving, I love the way he says that in the guitar at that point. But man, when it kicks into the oh, and then it's like, you know, talk, the way he sings it. And I felt the coldness of my winter. That part of the song is so awesome. I just wish they wouldn't have drug it out so long. You know, it's the old saying, don't bore us, get to the course. And they did not adhere to that principle. But once it kicks in, it's one of my favorite Zeppelin songs. And the first part's not bad. They just drag it out way too long. I think this is the only blunder I think they make as far as the flow on this album. I'm always a big fan. Even I talk about this. I'm a big fan of the third song being a mellow song on an album like this. I would have swapped it with The Ocean and closed with No Quarter, because that's the epic that's on here. But anyway, other than that, I got no complaints on it.
Something in the way she moves. It's got the first two chords of that in it too. I think that was Page's tip of the hat to him. Mm-hmm. Blam, blam. I don't know what they are. I don't have a perfect pitch. How do you follow up Stairway to Heaven? Here you go. You could call this the Mirror Universe Stairway. It's minor key, makes everything a bit off, uneasy. From the first two chords, there's a tension that lies in the entire movement. When the strings come, it's turned up a notch almost. Everything's got a blanket of melancholy over it. This is about as far from heavy metal as it gets, and it's heavy as fuck in its own way. The way it sets you up and emotionally for the ultimate climax is pure musical brilliance. And what's in between is as beautiful as a classical symphony. This is way higher art than wet ass pussy. Robert's in love again. It's the springtime of his loving. And you're the sunlight that he's been longing for. He's got a real connection with you, and fuck anyone that doesn't want you two to be together. No matter how perfect everything is, there's always some asshole that makes everything suck. No matter how happy you are, there's always something to fuck it up. Upon us all, a little rain must fall. The absolute desperation and sorrow is broken by the defiance of knowing this inevitable fact. Just a little rain, but it don't matter, because he loves her so. Blah! And with that, Bonzo hits the snare drum, and they switch to a major key, and all the tension that rode over this whole tune gets released like Phoebe Cates' tits from the red bikini top in Fast Times at Ridgemont High as Brad Hamilton blasts his load all over the windowsill, his pirate uniform, and that hideous 80s bathroom wallpaper. Holy shit, that's fucking powerful. One of the best in their catalog. Doesn't anyone ever fucking knock anymore?
What was the song that was playing for that scene?
Moving in stereo.
Oh, it's one of my favorite tunes. Song.
Yeah. Coming soon on it.
Sure, Make Me Follow Lou Again. Rain Song is probably in the top five Zeppelin tunes for me. I've always loved this tune. And it brings up a point that Jimmy Page has a really, really skilled way in his production style of recording acoustic and electric guitars together. It's a sound I've never heard anybody else kind of master. I mean, he can get a sound on an acoustic guitar on record better than most I've heard, but just the way he blends them together, it's very unique. And this was also the first time, it's a lot of firsts with Led Zeppelin, I realized with me, I ever heard strings in a rock setting. And I really enjoy the strings on this. I'm a sucker for a nice mellow tune, even though it amps up, you know, into the tune, it's an epic, but the mellow stuff, I think Zeppelin's really good at that. And, you know, they're known for being this big bombastic rock band, but they also have the ability to turn the dynamics down and really be successful with it in that avenue as well.
Well, like I said before, this was a song that Jimmy worked out most of in his home studio. As far as sequencing, if you ever hear the Song Remains the Same album, when they play the Song Remains the Same song and then they go right into this, it fits with what they were going for with the sequencing. Everybody stops and listens. That's an entire Madison Square Garden sold out show, and you could hear a pin drop when they start this song for the entire thing. And that whole audience is there just going, huh? So that's kind of what they were going for. But once Page got together with John Paul Jones, he kind of really upped the ante with his Mellotron and piano playing. The strings on it are the Mellotron, which is a really stupid pre-synthesizer kind of thing that had tape loops that would stretch in concert, and you could hear them get too hot under the lights and warp and warble while they played it. Page offers a wink and a nod to Beale George and something at the very beginning, and Plant sings about the love cycles of life as the four seasons. And unlike the previous song, the studio cut doesn't grate on my nerves in comparison to the live version. It is a very mellow and laid-back buildup. Page plays beautiful acoustic passages and puts in some dreamy swipes with his electric guitar. Bono plays this song with brushes up until 5 minutes and 2 seconds when he pulls out the sticks for that crescendo where John Paul Jones's piano and Mellotron and Page's noodling intertwine while Plant sings about us cursing the gloom that's set upon us. This is the mystery of the quotient. Upon us all, a little rain must fall. I always wondered what they were bringing in mathematics onto this song for, but that's a whole other story. I'm sure this was super unexpected from Zeppelin fans in 73, but I can't separate it from them. It's always been what I knew of them. Their ability to produce diverse styles while still sounding like them is uncanny. This song is an unlikely and mostly unheralded masterpiece. If you didn't know it already, these guys can fucking play.
Yeah, so I noted a lot of the same things. Acoustic ballad, the string section that's behind it is sets the template for a lot of others to copy it. I think back to when we were reviewing the Collective Soul record with The World I Know and the strings that are behind that. That's this, right? It's a recreation of this. In general, I struggle a little bit with the sort of long stretched out buildup if you dig it, you dig it. And no offense if you do, but for me, the point that Prof just mentioned, 502, that's to me when the song becomes something special. That's when everything kicks in, the full band with the strings, the keys, amazing. So all in all, 7 minute long song, the last 2 minutes to me are the best part. I struggle to get to the first 5 minutes knowing what song is next and being tempted to jump right over it to get there. But it definitely showcases a different side of a hard rock band.
You guys got to get the live version.
There's of course. So much I'm sure.
Zeppelin out there. Zeppelin is a live band. And that's where they shine.
I feel like we say that a lot. Yeah.
It's Robert Plant's sequence in this. You get to watch him ride save the damsel in distress and ride down the beach on a horse.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. That's really bad, but
that brings us to the next track, Over the Hills and Far Away.
Hey lady, you got the love I need. Maybe more than enough. Oh darling, 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 walk a while with me. Oh, you got so much, so much, so much.
This is probably one of the most overplayed acoustic riffs that Guitar Center employees get tortured with every day. Holy shit, what a riff. The other bands have coming home songs. Aerosmith had Home Tonight, Guns N' Roses has Paradise City. There's a bunch of coming home songs. Zeppelin's got Go In There songs. This one, Ramble On. Robert likes a traveling song. He likes to ramble. And here we are, Over the Hills and Far Away. Off to the Shire again. It starts off like a campfire song, but then it crashes in like a Led Zeppelin. See what I did there? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The stuttering reverb skips underneath Robert's shrieking verse. It's almost cha-cha in parts. Nothing stays too long to wear out its welcome, and the band turns on a dime each time. You're right. These guys can play. Can't stop my foot from tapping, and whenever this comes on, and I can't stay in a bad mood. The long fade out, they fake you out. And as it comes back in, you can almost feel the room get warmer as they hit that final note. It's great. I love this tune.
This is a fantastic tune. And it's probably one of their more signature tunes. As I mentioned at the top, FM radio had a field day with this one. You heard this constantly. And I often have a hard time separating myself from the number of times I've heard this song. But really, if you're able to step back from that, it really is It's a wonderful song. When I mentioned during the rain song about being able to record acoustic guitars sounding great, the acoustic at the beginning of this thing, the intro, is one of the best acoustic guitar recordings I've ever heard. The sound on it is so perfect. It's very hard to capture an acoustic properly. And I mean, you know, when it kicks into the electric part, I mean, there's nothing better than Zeppelin when they're at 110%, and this is 110%.
Well, the way this song fades in very quickly on the album, it always kind of makes me chuckle. It's as if Eddie Kramer was letting Page kind of warm up and then realized he's about to go for it. And Kramer presses the record button just in time. If you listen real close, you can hear it just pops in quick. It's that folky, hypnotic, and hooky acoustic passage, which Lou already said that every guy who ever learned how to play would crucify everybody he knew endlessly at parties or at dorm rooms in the 80s and the 90s. To make you want to do the I Gave My Love a Cherry to his guitar. The song is originally from the Led Zeppelin III writing sessions in Wales, hence the folky feel. The working title was Many, Many Times. Page had worked on it a bit at his home studio. Page starts with that riff on a 6-string acoustic, and then instead of double tracking it, he adds a 12-string acoustic accompaniment, which is just awesome. Plant comes in with that half-awake lyric that that builds along with the music to that dramatic and anticipated full band crashing in. Those last eight bars really ramp up the anticipation. This is Ramelon's big brother. Bonham's playing impressed me here. It's a slower shuffle that still has his signature wallop to it. And lyrically, it's loosely based on a Tolkien poem, or Tolkien, I can't pronounce his name. Tolkien poem from 1915 of the same title, with some vague Lord of the Rings BS sprinkled in, but it's all sufficiently vague enough to make it relatable to the masses. Page's solo here puzzled me for a bit. He was bending notes with some added reverb and some extra studio tricks until I listened really closely to the officially released live versions. He's using a slide, but it's not a metal slide or a glass one. It's a ceramic one, and it doesn't have that tinny string scrape of the metal one or the glassy gloss of a glass one. His solo mixes with the rhythm guitar track in a trance-like sound. The outro is Jimmy's guitar in heavy echo and John Paul Jones' clavinet, replaying the original riff with a harpsichord as well, and swelling into that final fade out. This is just an awesome song, and they would stretch this one out live.
Once again, I get stuck going behind the professor. The intro of this is just like butter. That acoustic guitar, it sounds so good. You mentioned the fade out. How many people the first time that came on the radio, DJs messed that one up? Like, you know, hey, thanks for, oh, here it comes back again. This is one of my more favorite Zeppelin songs. And as we go through this, I never have paid attention to just how many of these songs you still hear on classic rock radio. Over half of these, at least the classic rock that I listen to, this is going to pop up on. You know, one of the things that I like about them on this album was the constant change of pace. And everything just wasn't, I guess, like a four on the floor rock song. Like you've had with some of the other stuff. And they largely got away from the blues on this one, which they started that with some of the earlier albums. But, you know, those first two albums, that's all it was just their take and stealing the blues from poor Delta musicians. I love it. And I love, you know, let me pull up the lyrics because I always mess them up. Hey, lady, you got the love that I need. It's so clear to hear. And it sounds so cool. And then when they go into the many have I loved and many times been bitten. For the longest time, I didn't even know what they were saying. It's just, it sounded cool. The melody of it and Plant's inflection of his voice. So I've got no complaints with this song whatsoever. If I went and saw Zeppelin, if they somehow got back together, this is one of the ones I'm like, you got to put it in the set, along with a lot of songs on this album, to be honest with you.
Yeah, for me, just to wrap it up, I mentioned in a previous episode that I am world-renowned air guitarist. And this track is one of the ones that is earned my accolades late nights while I'm supposed to be doing the dishes and instead have my headphones on and air guitaring the crap out of this song with some intermittent air frontman, because those lyrics and the way that Robbie sings those, hey lady, you got the love I need. Oh, love that. Oh my goodness. It's just so good. Maybe more than enough. It's so good. It's unbelievable. You left out
the, oh, darling, darling, darling.
I know, but I have to pick my spots.
Please don't encourage him any further, David.
Oh, exactly. You've got so much.
Exactly. We could just all sit around the campfire and sing this song.
Lou missed the crooning.
No, he's got his headphones on. He heard it.
He didn't miss anything.
I got wireless.
This is everything Led Zeppelin is in one song. It's all the acoustic masterfulness that Page does. It's all of the various vocal effects that Rob does. It's all of the contributions that Bonham brings to the table, John Paul Jones, all of his different elements there, everything
that time changes.
Exactly. Yeah. Like all of the staple stuff that is Led Zeppelin exists in this song.
But is this pretty much kind of the coming out party for what we would think of with John Paul Jones going forward? This album? No Quarter.
No, because he has been their secret weapon from day one. So from the very first album, he was bringing in the keys, and he's a master arranger, which mm-hmm. sounds bad, but yeah, he was really, most of the songs from the 60s, the pop hits that you knew, he had a hand in. If they came from England, he mm-hmm. was that good. So he was just that guy. You know, that yeah, little REM album that Vultures he did.
With guys from like Queen of the Stone Age and Foo Fighters. He's like probably 65 years old.
Automatic point. For the People.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of people forget about that.
Yeah, he was, and all those Kinks hits, everything, like so much from the early 60s he was involved in. Mm-hmm. And he arranged for those bands.
Long story short, the song rules. Counter to that, we get to the next song, which is, how do you say this? Is this The Crunge?
The Crunge.
Should be called The Cringe.
The hell happened? We were having a nice album here, and then this goes on. This song is funny, and it's intended to be funny. Take me to the confounded bridge and all that, and but it annoys me to no end that there were other songs from these sessions left off to put this on the album. The fucking song called Houses of the Holy was left off, and this is on the album. So there's some cool elements to it. But it never quite gels for me, this tune, and it saves this album from being perfect from start to finish, in my opinion.
Well, this is the much maligned song, The Crunge. It's just them playing around. This song grew out of a studio jam. It's funky, and I agree, it's not them. This is where they're trying to get to when they come up with Trampled Underfoot in the next album. It's total filler, although they said this song happened by accident, and they called it a happy accident. You can hear the fun that they're having playing and bonding musically once again with this song. The funky drum pattern, that bass line, are my favorite parts of the song. The lyrics, well, they suck, except for the nod to, Otis's Mr. Pitiful. Jimmy's James Brown style playing quickly becomes annoying. John Paul Jones's Hammond organ and clavinet part are interesting. He's channeling a little Stevie Wonder in there. And something that always draws my attention, while Plant is yammering on incoherently, I can remember my friends in high school discussing, what the hell did they mean by, have you seen the bridge? I knew it referred to the bridge of the song, but what we didn't know, it was a James Brown signal for, hey, let's hit the turnaround and end this song already. I don't skip this song, but I'm always slightly glad when it's over. Have you seen the bridge? Have you seen the ending of this song?
This song is Ishtar bad. This is, I knew Lou was going to get it, man. I've been holding on to that one. I mean, it's like they had this piece of music. They don't have any lyrics, and like Plant's just coming up with them. They should have called it The Cringe. This is one of the absolute worst songs in their catalog. Here's the thing though. It's on the album. You have to consider it when you're giving your star rating. I mean, they laid a turd here. This is not good. And then singing like, where's the bridge at the end? And I'm like, where's the song, man? This is awful. I'm like Ian, like you have this other material and this is what gets on it. I mean, Houses of the Holy, you can't put it on the name of the album.
The Rover?
I mean,
yeah, The Rover.
Black Country Woman. All three of them.
I mean, anyway, this one's just bad. It's Ishtar bad. That was for Lou.
I was never a fan of this tune. And I had a friend back in high school that told me the story about how Jimmy Page started fucking around with black magic, going as far as moving into Crowley's castle. And all of this fucked up shit started happening to the band as a result. And Robert was singing about the devil here. Let me tell you about my good thing. I ain't disclosing no names, but he sure is a good friend. And I ain't going to tell you where he comes from. If I tell you, you won't come again. It's the devil, man. They sent a contract at the crossroads and their fame became legendary. They sang his praises in an indirect fashion and they got immense fame and fortune. And then a bunch of shit happened right after. He lost his vocal range. He got in a horrible car accident with his wife, almost losing his leg. Then his son, Carrick, died from a stomach virus. By the time In Through the Outdoor came around, he was a shadow or a shell of himself. Oh, and the band lost their drummer. I mean, upon us all, a little rain must fall, eh? Anyway, here's to our heroes ripping off, paying tribute to their heroes once again. This time it's James Brown. John Paul Jones gets to use his new EMS VCS3 synthesizer, and Robert searches for his bridge. Have you seen the bridge? Where's that confounded bridge? This would be Lou's obligatory skipper on every record. Loser.
Got to figure out how to make a sound effect with that.
Loser.
And they're one of those teen movies where, like, it slows up and somebody's going, loser.
Yeah, I'll play with the timing of the play. Whatever. Here's my take. This song sucks. Next. Now we flip the imaginary record over and we drop the imaginary needle on Dancing Days.
This song is Kashmir's little brother. It's that Eastern Serpentine main riff that drives the song along. It was inspired by a song they heard in India. This song also inspired an awkward ZZ Top Van Hager-type dance on the lawns of Stargroves during their initial playback that they keep telling us about, which no one wants to know about. The song has that hypnotic snake charmer quality, with Plant singing about seeing a lion standing along with a tadpole in a jar, another passage that caused great speculation. Well, not quite as good as Lou's stretch to go for the satanic panic that he just did. But in reality, it was just simple word painting, putting words or passages that sound good together, and their meaning, if there is any, is coincidental. Think Wings' Jet or the Stones' Casino Boogie on that. The production on this one is a little sharp. The main riff, Jimmy's slide licks, as well as Jones's added keyboards overdubs, cause more than some ear fatigue because they're so tinny sounding. They had envisioned this song to be the summer of 1972 anthem. Well, that didn't quite work out, did it? It's not a bad song at all. It just, I sometimes, especially in headphones, I can't hear it because it's just too sharp.
And I love it. It sounds great. I love like the little guitar lick. It almost sounds like it's going to you like in a circle. It's a happy song, one of the happier songs that they do. I love the line, "I've got my flower, I've got my power." A little bit of homage to, I guess, the late 60s there. No, this one I think has a cool beat. They're incorporating some of those world type sounds that they're going to use later on in their career. You're talking about covers. The Stone Temple Pilots cover of this is fantastic. But like we said, this is another one that I hear it all the time on classic rock radio whenever I listen to it. It's a happy song. It's a feel-good song. It's one of those ones I don't get tired of listening to. You know, there's some Zeppelin songs I'm complete, like Whole Lot of Love. I can't listen to it anymore. I'm done with it, you know. Just heard it so many times. Obviously, Stairway to Heaven and Rock and Roll. But anyway, a great track on here. And like we said, there's just such a high percentage of well above average songs on here. And this one is one of those. Like I said, if you've never heard Stone Temple Pilots do it, do yourself a favor and go listen to it. I know Ian's a massive STP fan.
This one wastes no time getting to the point. The symmetry between the keyboards and Jimmy Serpentine rhythm multi-tracks slink through like a snake. You said it, Prof. Through the reeds, stalking its cute and fuzzy prey. The song sounds almost like Kashmir on 45. There's an intangible darkness to the sound, almost a menacing tone like a wolf in sheep's clothing. God knows what Robert's babbling on about. He seems to have upped the psychedelics since the second record. It really hasn't hurt his libido any either. I told your mama I'd get you home, but he didn't say I got no car. I saw a lion. He was standing alone with a tadpole in a jar. What the fuck are you babbling about, Robert? Good thing you got no car. You're tripping your balls off. Go play with each other in the corner. Here's some fruit. Jimmy solo and chants like a snake charmer, blowing his horn at the serpent in the basket. A hint of Middle Eastern flair flavors this whole tune, and I really dig it a lot.
Again, positioning me after Lou. I've always really liked this song. David mentioned, you know, hearing a whole lot of love a lot and a lot of songs that you kind of get ear fatigue from hearing them so much. This is actually one of those songs that is played a lot, at least in my neck of the woods, on radio, or was at the time I was paying attention to FM radio. But I never really got tired of this song because it's very upbeat, and I really like this. I always find something to like in this when I'm listening to it, even, you know, 25, 30 years after hearing it for the first time. And lately it's been John Paul Jones's keyboard additions to it. I really like how the little colorations he puts in with that. But this is, it's a Zeppelin classic. And this album, I didn't realize it till going back and listening to it for this episode, just how many classic Zeppelin songs are on this record. It's pretty impressive. It's kind of like their hidden gem in a way.
It's sneaky how many songs are still played.
Mm. Yeah, again, like I said, it's wedged between, you know, four and then Physical Graffiti. So it's super easy to overlook. And then imagine if they got rid of that bullshit song, The Crunge, and actually put the title song on here. Now I'd take it away from Physical Graffiti, but this would be right up there with the most classic records ever. And it maybe is anyway, but Dancing Days was my gateway into Led Zeppelin. This is the track, and it's that Stone Temple Pilots cover. That's the first track I ever heard that I was like, wow, that's interesting. I really dig that. I want to check out where that came from. So to me, in that aspect, like, the groove is iconic. The riff is iconic. I don't know how much this song is considered a Led Zeppelin classic, but to me, being one of the very first songs I ever heard that was a Led Zeppelin song, it will always be a This Is Led Zeppelin song to me. So I dig it a ton. And in that same vein, because it was on that same record, we come next to, okay, what is it? Jamaica. All right, David, you're up for Jamaica.
Oh,
got a little of a mixture between reggae and like 50s doo-wop music. This is one that you play somewhere and the ladies like this one because they like to dance to it. I tend to think it's one of the more overrated songs in the catalog, maybe because it gets played a lot, but it's just, I don't know, there's something about it that's very annoying to me and always has been. This is, like we said, there's two I don't like, and this is the second one on here. And there's just something about, I know it's supposed to be reggae tinge, but it's almost like the guitar and everything is a little bit too far behind the beat. Sounds very disjointed to me. And I understand why people like it, especially, you know, why women like it, but it comes from the punchline of a joke, I believe. And I know there was some arguing back and forth between Paige and Plant. I don't think Paige liked it, and Plant wanted it to be a single. And so they went with that. Obviously, the lead singer usually wins in that scenario. But you could have put something else on here. And like I said, it's like the other song. You have to bring down the star rating a little bit because this is on there. It's not a popular opinion. I don't think it's quite to Hot Take Hudson level. But the way Lou's nodding makes me feel good.
Yeah, I'm definitely on Team David here. So having pumped the Black American music well dry, after completely appropriating classic blues and R&B now, they move further south to the Caribbean rhythms of Jamaica. Here, Robert's cod reggae attempt at a reggae hit are successful for the most part, as it was probably the biggest hit of the record. It's so overplayed on rock radio that it's got a bit of an ear burn for me. But, you know, hey, that doesn't mean it's a bad tune, but it's Led Zeppelin, so I'll just shut the fuck up.
This song for me is always saved by John Bonham's drumming on it. I think it's fantastic. And it's actually a little ironic, I think, because I remember reading that John Bonham did not like this song because he wasn't a fan of reggae and the drum beat. And you know, it wasn't his scene. But and yet he turns in such a great performance on this. I have a hard time like divorcing myself from the history I have with these songs. And like maybe it's not the best track on the album, but it's like ingrained in my music DNA because I've heard it so much. And much like a lot of other bands of this caliber, I can usually find something to like in most of their songs. And that's, so I kind of, this is a bottom tune for me that saves it from being a total clunker.
Well, this is another much maligned song. Now think of it. You just heard When the Levee Breaks, and then this song drops on your needle. I'm sure that's caused a lot of RCA dog moments back in 73 when it came out. It's a doo-wop structured song with a reggae beat. And reggae was quite the rage in 72 and 73 among English bands. That's because Bob Marley and the Wailers was living in London at the time, and they were the biggest underground rage there. The band themselves regard this as filler and a goof, but it was released as the second single after Over the Hills and Far Away. And I just remember on the album, it had that little brown circular sticker on it declaring includes Jamaica, which most people in the U.S. pronounced as Dire Maker, not being familiar with the Jamaican joke from England. I don't dislike this song. It's just fun. But when I think of Zeppelin, I don't think of this song.
It's the outlier.
Yeah.
In the catalog.
Well, I first heard this song. It's a Sheryl Crow cover off that Encomium CD.
You kids are breaking most of me up.
Her version is much better.
It just makes me laugh because I'm coming at it from such a completely different perspective.
You are.
I knew it as Zeppelin, and yep. I know that Encomium album. And I was like, the Stone Temple Pilots version was so good. And I'm like, really? I didn't think it was all that great when I first heard it.
But for us that grew up in the 90s.
I get it. It's just funny. It's just like you guys are discovering the Beatles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
and other band that Paul McCartney was in.
The one without his wife. John Lennon's wife was in that one.
So here's what I can say. I really liked the Sheryl Crow cover. It was fine. I dug it. Now that I know that the name is not Dire Maker, it's whatever the fuck that other thing is. This song can suck it. We'll move on. The next song, our beloved brothers dip into a little bit of psychedelia, which is unique, I think, in the catalog for Led Zeppelin, or at least the first time. The next track is No Quarter.
Close the door, put out the light. No, they won't be home tonight. The snow falls hard, and don't you know? The winds of Thor are blowing cold. They're wearing steel that's bright and true.
I think this defines the epic tune genre. John Paul Jones' Mellotron, spread the blanket over you as you board the ship and take your seat. Soon the ship takes off and you're blasted into the dark reaches of outer space. Weightless, you spin. Jimmy in your left ear, John Paul Jones' organ tethering you to life as Bonham fires the rocket engines, propels you through this masterpiece of mood. Soon the afterburn flames out and extinguishes, leaving you floating in bent space, weightless. Only your thoughts and a lone piano in the distance as the low, steady glow of Bonham's drums firing like thrusters, keeping you on course in the background. Jimmy, seemingly telling a story in some unknown guitar language, babbles in your left ear and out your right. Another voice floats nearby. Robert's singing is solemn, almost foreboding, warning us no matter which path to choose, they have no favorites, no passes, no one's invincible. Here in its studio incarnation, it only hints at the vast improvisational launch pad it becomes in concert. Unbelievable tune in its simplicity. Tool does my favorite cover version of it, but it still doesn't match the original in any way. It affects my mood. This is just a phenomenal track. I can't say enough about it.
One of the most amazing things to me about Led Zeppelin is they can do something like No Quarter, where in the hands of many, many other bands, this would be very pretentious and self-indulgent. And for some reason, when they do things like this, it's not. It's captivating in a way. And Lou is absolutely right. This is the definition of an epic track. And one that early on when I was younger, I didn't appreciate as much. I came to really like this song, and it's a front runner for one of the best tracks on the album for me now. I will say this though, when they did the unleaded, the Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, the kind of unplugged thing they did, the version of No Quarter they do on that is unbelievably good. And Prof
is giving you the stink face.
I know, I'm ignoring him. But because I love him, so I don't want, you know, we don't. but it's worlds away from what it sounds like on this record, and I can understand, you know, people not liking the different version of it, but I always really, really appreciated it.
Well, this is John Paul Jones's homework. It's what he brought from his home studio. This is originally from the Headley Grange Led Zeppelin 4 sessions. And there's a faster version of it out there floating around if you want to listen to that. Jones took some time with it at home, and this is what he brought to the table. It's a keyboard-driven song providing him with a moment to shine on stage because they no longer played Thank You. It's a song that they could stretch out for a good 30 minutes on stage. And spoiler alert, it's a masterpiece. Jones's warbling, brooding keyboard intro is his Hohner electric piano being put through a synthesizer, and the Hohner electric piano is it's like a really bad copy of a Fender Rhodes. It's metal on metal instead of being the reeds that the Wurlitzer is. Before Jimmy comes in with that distorted, foreboding, hypnotic riff that you know is just driving you to your eventual doom, Bonham goes through a few time signature changes, but as usual, All the transitions are silky smooth and almost unnoticeable. Plant puts in a jazzy solo that is accented by some tasteful synth washes. On stage, Page used the theremin for the Dogs of Doom part, but it sounds like a synth here in the studio track. The song has that great trot. It's not quite a gallop to it, but it's just a good trot. Another song taken with the previous four albums had their fans going, huh? But this is just a great tune. And live, it's, like I said, they're a live band. Live is even better. And the fade out here really kind of seems appropriate for this song to me. So usually I kind of poo-poo fade outs, but it works here.
Step aside, Stairway to Heaven. This is the real epic from this band. It's a top five Led Zeppelin song for me. I love that build up. I love that they drag it out. Now, for our Black Crowes fans here, and Ray's about to pass out when I say this, the live versions of Moving On Down the Line, that long build up to me, have a little similarity to No Quarter. Mm-hmm. But like, you see them play this live and it's like kind of almost spooky, you know, and you'll see them sometimes with like the fog coming, the smoke coming up on the stage. And, you know, they like to sing about Lord of the Flies and stuff like this. And this is about the Vikings. And he's talking about the winds of Thor blowing cold. The song's also got a creepy vibe to it. I've always thought that it sounds a little out of place on this album, but then I'm like, what album would you put this on? Because it's so much different than the other songs that they do. This John Paul Jones, man, this is his song. And I love that they played it on that that night that they got back together. And I was really happy to see them do that. They clearly enjoy playing it, and it lets, you know, John Paul Jones really shine. But in reality, all members of the band shine on this. Bonham's drums are so good on it. And then obviously Plant's lyrics are really cool. And, you know, Jimmy kind of steps aside a little bit and lets John Paul Jones have more of the spotlight on this, which I wish they would do more. But I guess Jimmy Page still thinks highly of himself. Hey, so you guys were talking about him moving into that. Was it Aleister Crowley's house?
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Page, there is a podcast and I forget the name of it, but they talk about that. Apparently something happened in that house with David Bowie that freaked David Bowie out so much. I don't think he and Jimmy Page ever even talked again. Have you heard about that, Lou?
I have, but I haven't. I heard a vague story about it, but I can only imagine David Bowie walking out of that place, running out, shrieking.
It either involved like something levitating or a dog or something like that. Anyway, Jesus. I don't know why I brought that in. But yeah, this is top shelf, top five for me. It's one of those songs when I first got into them that I was just drawn to, because it's also a very heady song and fits into that, you know, kind of stoner vibe. And I haven't heard the Tool version. I was just reading about it on Wikipedia. Mm. I'll have to give that a listen because I can imagine they do a great job with this.
Well, incidentally, that house is called Boleskin House. It was built on a church property where the entire congregation was inside and died in a fire. And that's why Crowley built it on top of that. And Crowley was a weirdo. Page bought it and it has since burnt down. I think sometime in the mid 2010, somewhere on there, it burnt down, burnt to the ground. That was it. So It's on Loch Ness. That's all I know. And you couldn't get to it because when I was in England, we tried. So,
all right. Well, I get to wrap it up. This, having listened to every Zeppelin record, maybe not as much as I would like to, but enough to be vaguely familiar with it, this is probably the most unique song in their entire catalog. This is the dip their toe into the psychedelia, like I said in the intro, that inspired, as we've talked about, bands such as Tool, who appropriately covered. There's no band that should cover a song like this except Tool. You know, this is the type of thing that led to prog metal, in my opinion. And they do it just masterfully. That I could say all the same things you guys said, and I'm gonna spare it for time's sake, but for me in particular, I'm just gonna call out some timestamps because I want people to hear this. 3 minutes in, The organ, piano, the bass, all of this, they layer upon each other one instrument at a time. At 3:52, the drum groove starts kicking in, the guitar lick that builds into the solo. It's very heavily affected. This set the blueprint, I think, for a lot of the prog metal type situations that we'll see in the future and in the 90s. Of course, I'm very familiar with the Tool cover. As I said, very appropriate way to do it. This is a song you can just get lost into. It's one of my all-time favorite songs. And I hear what Smashing Pumpkins did. I can hear what Tool did. I can hear a lot of these 90s post-grunge industrial type bands stole a lot of this idea and built a whole career on it. And so good on Led Zeppelin for being the OGs.
So do you know that there's like this thing that's there's some people that can hear music and they see colors?
Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. No.
So I forget what that's called, but yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember what the name of it is.
Synesthesia.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this album is orange, and most of this album, to those people, they see the color orange, which is kind of cool that they did this.
And isn't the background of the album orange?
Yeah, except for this song, which most people say that all the music on this, everybody associates this with like the summertime, right? Like this is a good summertime album.
The record.
This song is the dead of winter.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
This song is freezing cold up north. Frozen lakes.
It's probably, I love it. I live in Michigan.
Barren, overcast. Put this song on. That's what the mood is. So I just thought that was interesting because I had somebody that could see colors when I knew him, and he would talk to me about colors. And I thought, my God, what kind of acid did you take when you were in high school? But it's a real thing. So
interesting.
And as Lou said, it's synesthesia. So
all right. Well, that brings us to the final track on the record, which is called The Ocean.
Like the intro to this, I like when bands have like studio chatter included on the record, but I just like something about the way Bonham says, "We've done four already, but now we're steady." And then they went 1, 2, 3, 4. I just think that's really cool. This is to me, and I know David had mentioned perhaps placing it in a different running order in the album, but I think this works great as a closer. I think it's so cool, and that little a cappella breakdown they do.
Na 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 na.
Brilliant. I can't say enough things about this. I went, you guys have mentioned various points throughout this whole discussion here that, you know, this song sounds like what Led Zeppelin's all about. And at least from the rock aspect of Led Zeppelin, this is that sound. Like, this is what I think of if someone mentions Led Zeppelin and is focused on the more rock aspects of the band.
Well, this is a song about their concert crowds. Singing to the ocean, I can hear the ocean's roar. It's got that live kind of in your, when you listen to it, you feel like you're in the room with them. But if you listen closely, you can hear that they played with the true speed of this tape too. The cymbal crashes are ridiculously short. And that's the big telltale sign. But I love Bonham's fills in this. And Page stabbing in with them. That's just kind of a high point. Now the na-na-na-na-na-na-na is kind of great on me a little bit. And they do that kind of weird switch to the doo-wop shadooby-doo at the end. It seems like they got a little lazy and just kind of put on an unfinished track to a point. But then they played it live all the time after this. So I'm not saying it's a bad tune. It just kind of seems unfinished to me.
Didn't Beastie Boys sample this?
What didn't they sample?
Well, I mean,
originality.
Before I heard the Zeppelin version of this song, I heard it, you know, in a Beasties album. This, the opening with the rhythm, not the rhythm, with the guitar playing, almost reminds me of, maybe it's a kissing cousin of a Heartbreaker. It's got that kind of concise roll there. Another song that people that you didn't think were fans of Led Zeppelin have heard this on the radio and know it, which is a common theme here. I don't have much more to say about it other than it's a great song. I love the beat. I love the melody that they use. John Bonham plays great on this, and we haven't mentioned his name very much, but quite possibly the greatest rock drummer of all time. And, you know, nobody can duplicate what he did. And the thing I think is interesting about this band is they truly are the sum of their parts. Nobody here is bad. Everybody's really good. And everybody kind of gets a phase, I think, in the band where they really kind of take over. Obviously, Presence and In Through the Outdoor were heavily influenced by John Paul Jones with his arrangements. Those first couple albums are Jimmy Page, you know, albums. And then I think Robert Plant really gets to shine a lot on Led Zeppelin 3 and Led Zeppelin 4. And then Houses of the Holy and Physical Graffiti, they really just meld as this big melting pot of musicians that are on the top of their game, and the most creative, I think, was on that album. Obviously, there were some songs recorded from these sessions that made it on there. But I think it's, like I said, I would have closed it out with No Quarter. You ended on this big epic note, and I would have thrown this in at number two and moved Rain Song maybe down to song number three. But I mean, guys, like this is such a good album to listen to. And just as we're going through this, it keeps hitting me. I know I keep repeating myself, keeps hitting me over and over again. All but maybe Rain Song and The Crunge, there's a good chance if you listen to 24 hours of classic rock radio, you're going to hear them, which speaks. And like you said, you hear people that are fans don't really refer to this album all this much. And it's eight songs and six of them are phenomenal. But they got the unwanted position of being between one of the biggest albums of all time and then the album that people think is their creative peak. So I don't have a lot more to say about this song other than it's great.
You learn something every day. That thing that Bonham says at the beginning of talking about the first four records. I could never make out what he said. We've done four already. Now we're steady. And then they went 1, 2, 3, 4. But let's be honest. This is a mess. But it works. It's an English pub sing-along. It's an arena rocker with a 50s Cochran 50s throwback mashed in the middle. I think he had a riff he didn't know what to do with, and he mashed it with a doo-wop idea that Robert probably had, and the rest of them had a jam on it. And the next thing you know, it's the fucking ocean from Houses of the Holy. End of story.
You're probably right. And probably it does seem thrown together.
Exactly. Some of the bands that we've talked about have this idea of this loose but tight, right? And to this point, this band has been nothing but tight. And this is where we get an example of where they can be loose but tight. This is a song that feels like it's going to fall apart, but the timing of it, the groove of it, all of it holds together by a carious string. And this is another one where I love the vocals, and I already sang for you, so I'm not going to do it again, but singing in the sunshine and laughing in the rain. I just love that. This is a song that's on my playlist that when I'm on vacation, it inevitably comes up in the cycle and it plays for me. There's something about it that's very playful and fun. And I also have in my notes, Ian, that vocal breakdown at 219, where it's just the harmonies and so forth. That's very unique and different, and I love it. And little backing vocals and little oohs and stuff. And man, Bono's playing a freaking heavy ass groove, and it's a lot of fun to listen to. So while it might not be a perfectly structured song like Over the Hills and Far Away, and it might not be the big epic that we love like No Quarter, it's a fun little jam, and I don't dislike it. I like it just fine, and it has a special place in my heart from where I listen to it all the time. All right, now that the track by track is done, we're going to give our final thoughts and album ratings. For our veteran and new listeners, just a reminder, our scale is a 0 to 5, where a 5 is a favorite of ours. And a 0 is going to be Tossed, Over the Hills and Far Away.
Puns.
Well, they're always puns.
I know.
For the score. It's just how it works. Lou, your thoughts first.
You don't realize how great of a band Zeppelin is until you start going through the track lists of their records. And this one reads like a greatest hits album. Somebody mentioned it before. There's so many good songs on it. I'd call this the 2-0 version of the band as they changed their sounds since the steady morph between the pure rocket-fueled blues of the first to the more subdued rootsy sound of the third to that monolith that followed with the Runes album. This is the perfect follow-up to Zeppelin 4 and the perfect precursor to the next, Physical Graffiti. But here's where the good times ended for the band, and you can hear the strain in the next three records. With that, I give House of the Holy a 4.5. It's almost perfect, but David's right. It's got those two songs.
I mean, you know, we've said it over the course of this episode here, but this is a really, as David put it, a real sneaky classic in the Led Zeppelin catalog. And I forgot just how much I liked it and just how much it is representative of them as a band. And I give this a 4 overall. And that 1 star is lost purely for the crunch.
So I give this a 4.25. You take those two songs off and I give it a solid 4.5. I think it is for most bands, this would be something they could only dream of writing. And this is one of probably the three best Led Zeppelin albums. So in a short amount of time, their output was significant. A lot of casual fans know these songs, whether they know the names of them or not, because they hear them everywhere. You even hear some of these songs like in a shopping mall now, which is wild to me. But 4.25, give it a 4.5. You put Houses of the Holy on here over the crunch. You leave Jamaica on here if you do that. But man, were they good, and they were hitting their stride between, to me, the sweet spot is 4 to Physical Graffiti. This one sandwiched right in the middle, and like I said, it sold over 10 million copies just in America. So a juggernaut of an album, signaled some stylistic changes that were going to go even further on the next couple of albums, but I enjoyed coming on here and doing this one.
Well, so May 1972, they went on tour of the States, and there's an album from that they found when they were doing they were looking for the footage for the 2002 DVD. We found out that they had an album that they had recorded called How the West Was Won. And it takes two shows from the LA Forum and then one from Long Beach. And that is an absolutely fantastic performance. And, you got to remember, Led Zeppelin was the reason that you can see bands today that play for 3 hours, because they were doing it back then. Mm. And they were the only one doing it back then. And that made every other band angry because they had to come up with more material to play live. Like you said, David, the reason that other bands couldn't pull this off is they didn't have four members that had the chops that these guys had. These guys were just at the absolute peak. Well, in May 72, they were just starting to hit that absolute peak that they had. And according to a Led Zeppelin internet fan base, they really hit it in England in 1973 in January. That's their absolute peak live. They recorded this right in the middle of all that. And then they came out with Physical Graffiti. But looking at this album in hindsight, you know, being 2020, you can really see where they were going. This is an album that they were right after Four. The record company was going to leave them alone. They still had a chip on their shoulder about the press. And it seems to me like as a group, like it's a group of friends that finally got their driver's licenses and the free use of a car. And they're excited by the possibilities and their newfound freedom. But they don't really have any idea where they want to go with it yet. They had said in interviews at the time that there was much more to them musically than the critics could see. The critics lumped them in with Deep Purple, Grand Funk, and Sabbath, and they insisted they were no one-trick ponies by any means. With two flat-out masterpieces on this album, I'd even go so far as to say three with Over the Hills and Far Away, and what they produce next, I'd say they're definitely not a one-trick pony. It's a solid 4.25 as a Zeppelin album. However, it's easily my least listened to Zeppelin studio recording, and I include Presence, Into the Outdoor, and Coda in that summation. I just don't like them neutered. It's polished and thinny and tin and the chipmunk vocals, and it just doesn't have that bottom that I want from Zeppelin. Any other band, this would be a five all day that they would hang their hat on and try to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on. Then again, the album, like their entire catalog, but this album has gone platinum 11 times. 1 million copies is one platinum. It's a diamond release. It is the third best-selling album behind number two, which beats it by 1 million, and number four, which beats it by 12 million.
Hmm.
So this is, you know, coming after Four, you knew it was going to get a big jump because everybody wanted to hear it. But then, you know, it's not nearly as good as Physical Graffiti, and it's not nearly as good as Four. But damn, this is a good album. So, but I don't think Zeppelin put out a bad album.
A lot of these songs, I only affiliate them with the 90s covers that came in. So I'm speaking for that Gen X generation that get in our DeLorean and go back in time, and we took off the crunch and we took off whatever the hell that other song is that's not Dire Maker and put on songs like the title track, right? And put on maybe The Rover or maybe Black Country Woman that were recorded in these sessions. This record could have been a solid five. It would have taken a little bit away from Physical Graffiti, of course, but the tracks were there. And I think they did make some bad decisions in terms of that. But all in all, I have to give this record a four. This is an easy one to listen to front to back, because the good news is even the song that sucks the worst, The Crunch, is only like 3 minutes long, so you can get through it. Suck it up. You'll be okay.
I got to say, it's a misnomer to think that if you took those songs off of Physical Graffiti, it would lessen that album in any way, shape, or form. The core songs that they recorded for Physical Graffiti is what makes that album. The rest was just throwaway. So,
I mean, yeah, you think about what
Time of Dying and Kashmir, yep, and
10 years Gone.
Yep. 10 years Gone. Come on. Those are
oh, just, yeah,
a funky keyboard solo too. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just that's a magnum, yeah, opus of an album.
It so, is
confounded bridge.
And in retrospect, again, like we have the gift of hindsight, right? If they could have looked back and realized they would have all of those legendary monster songs available to them, they probably wouldn't have held these songs back. That's what I have to think. So,
I mean, they put Boogie with Stu on Physical Graffiti.
I mean, I kind of dig Boogie with Stu.
Mm. Cocaine, sell of a drug.
That's it. It's a fun time. All right, for the R4 podcast, I have been Jason Dantzis.
I'm the professor.
I'm Ian Rice.
I'm Lou Figaro.
And I'm David Hudson.
See ya.
The Ridiculous Rock Records Review podcast is hosted by Jason Dantzis, David Hudson, Sean Hillman, and Ian Rice. Show produced and directed by Jason Dantzis. Logo by David Hall. theme music from the Steepwater Band. Find them online at steepwater.com. If you have questions, comments, feedback, or ideas for the show, or just want to connect, find us on your favorite social media platform at R4Podcaster, or email us at ridiculousrockrecords@gmail.com. The R4 Podcast was created by Aaron Martell. Thank you for dropping the needle with us. Until next time, rock on.
But I don't think Johnny Cochran was there. He was too busy.
Johnny
defending OJ.
Yeah, OJ, so. The glove doesn't fit.
I think he means
Eddie Cochran, not Johnny Cochran. Whoops.
I'll try to dub in you saying Eddie in there. Try to figure it out.
Let him hang.
Yeah.
Let me hang.
Let him dangle.
It's late in the podcast.
It is late.
I'm very stoned.